are listening to an unpopular podcast.
Welcome to another sitting of the Thing Committee, Australia's definitive authority on things. Introducing your hosts, Josh Withers and Steve Malk.
Welcome to another edition of the Thing Committee podcast. My name's Josh Withers and also Steve Mock, my co-host. Hello, Steve.
Very comfortable on this couch, Joshua.
Yeah, I'm doing some nice home recording. I like the couch and being all comfy and nice. It's good.
It's awkward, but in a nice touchy-feely way.
Joining the podcast today, first of all, Nick Morgan-Moore. Hello, sir.
Hello.
Hello.
Yay.
Nice to meet you, Mark. Nice to see you again, Josh. It's been a while.
Yeah, I've been avoiding you.
Me too. So. Yeah,
for 7 years, I just want to add in, before the podcast started, you talked about having not seen each other for 7 years.
Mm. Yeah.
All this fake camaraderie.
Well, what do you do when people say, you know, what do you make a crust doing? Well, what's your thing now?
Well, I'm actually between jobs, sadly.
That one.
So, yeah, that one sucks.
That's an awkward question to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. I describe myself as a stand-up comedian just because better than saying that I'm a bum. But it means the same thing, really.
It's not far off,
realistically. I'm traveling around doing all the comedy rooms that I can. I'm a staple of the Gold Coast comedy rooms and love all of the guys on the Gold Coast who do that and all the people who drive down from Brisbane to help us out.
So
and
tough. I reckon that'd be a tough game.
Yeah, it can be. That's the thing about it is that it's you never know. Sometimes you walk into a room and you think it's going to be good and you bomb. And the lesson you learn is to dust yourself off and just keep going. And you do the same set a week later to, you know, another room about the same. The people look the same or even a tougher crowd and they just lose it. I had a set a few weeks ago that I just best, so good. And there was an 80-year-old woman in the front row who almost choked to death laughing at a joke about me getting a blowjob. So you never know. You just never know when you walk in.
So much going on with that 80-year-old woman.
Yeah. Like, I didn't think she'd get it. And so, you know, I was like, I'll tell it anyway, you know, for the other people. And she was like, you go. So, yeah.
And also joining the podcast, John Birmingham.
Yay.
Hey.
Woo.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm loving this shit palette coffee table.
It's a good look.
Got here.
Do you want to know the story behind the palette?
I actually do, yeah.
This is a symbol of my wife and I's very first argument as a couple. And
she's in there.
She's yeah.
No, she suggested it. Josh didn't want it. Guess who won?
No, this coffee table is a symbol of that. It's not the result of the first argument. Brit saw a pallet coffee table on eBay. She bidded on it. She bid on it. Sorry, and she won. The gents, how much would you pay for? And not for this coffee table, but for a lesser, a pallet with wheels and maybe something on top. So a plain old pallet. Well, what would you pay?
$20.
I'm a man, so I don't really know about prices of furniture, but my brother's a carpenter, so he didn't mock me one up for free. But
yeah. JB?
If some bloke I knew down the pub, and I know that bloke said I got a Shen pallet, I'd say give you $20 for it.
Yeah. So she just paid $800.
Oh, my God.
For this pallet with wheels. And it looked cool. It was very hipster and very with it.
And were
very...
you married already?
No, we were engaged.
Oh,
and we could have got out. I still had time.
My jaw has not closed. It's still on my chest. $800.
And so I said, look, our people, like, the family you and I are creating, we don't pay $800
for
pallet coffee.
Our tribe.
Yeah, we don't do that. That's not a thing we do. And I said, I can nick a pallet from somewhere. I can get a bit of some wheels and some glue or sand it up. It'll look beautiful. It'll be free. And so as a result, we got rid of the coffee table. We managed to sell it to another sucker for $800.
Win.
And we actually had this commission. So this is actually a... some would call it a piece of art from a furniture creator person, and it was kind of a wedding gift to us. And you might see the name and the wedding date on the side, and it's sturdy. You could build a house in this thing. It's solid.
You've become part of the problem. Just buying it, like, I had pity for you. The fact that you then unsold said $800 pallet table makes you now like the devil incarnate.
Yeah, you didn't just pass on a pallet. You passed on an argument. That's what you did.
Yeah, but now he's owned it and he's like running a pallet coffee table franchise.
You realize how much they were worth and how you could make them for virtually nothing, and that's what's paid for this beautiful house.
But look, as the married men would know, you've got to find some kind of compromise in this, and arguments aren't a bad thing. Arguments are actually a good place to find out where each other's at and to try and come to a middle ground. That's why, you know, debates in Parliament's one of a great thing. Like, let's fight this out. Let's find out what your real values are and battle it out.
If only we actually argued at home with our significant other, well, like they do in Parliament. The former... Who is the speaker?
We used to do this at our place. Jane and I, we actually had this game where, for as long as we could keep it up, we would only talk like Bob Carr.
Nice.
My wife, I am going from this place henceforth to the kitchen. Whereupon, reaching the kitchen, I shall endeavour with all my might to make tea for the people of this apartment. If you would like to come on me with this journey, yada, yada, yada.
And wow, I see that.
Sexy times ensued.
You have a look at it now. PM Rudd, I've got a zip. I've got to go and make myself some tea. But it's that opportunity, right, that I think if we had the chance to resolve, to have our arguments like parliamentary question time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the honourable member for the bedsheets is acknowledged. Yes, I have a question for the member for income. What the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's good. That's good. It actually ties into a true joke of mine that I tell at stand-up, because I broke up with my girlfriend a little while ago. And I say that, you know, after a breakup, you think about why it didn't work and you try and work out all of the reasons. And I think the reason that me and my ex-girlfriend didn't work is because of communication. We didn't talk. We weren't on the same level. It didn't really work for that reason. And also, I shouldn't have slept with all of her friends. So that's probably a factor too.
It's about balance, Nick.
Yeah.
Life's about balance.
Yeah. So I'm going to say 50% of one, 50% of the other.
You're not to blame, though. I mean, they threw themselves.
No, that's right. It was the friends.
Yeah. They threw themselves. Yeah, that's absolutely.
No, it is a joke because she didn't have any friends.
Well, we'd like to welcome Nick's ex-girlfriend to the listening party.
I'll tell her that, yeah.
She's in.
Yeah, I'll tell her to listen. It's fine.
That's great.
She used to sit by while I do stand-up sets, and, you know, she was half my jokes. And so that was the thing that sucked the most about the breakup. I lost half my jokes. Because there's this period after you break up with someone where you can't tell any jokes about them. But then I got my stuff back. So, yeah, now it's a free-for-all.
You play on.
Shall we get down to the important business of being a thing committee?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd like to open up the committee with a question, and this is actually from a listener of the committee, and
we have them now. You now can't find the device on which it's contained, do you? Wow, this is radio of the mind.
I had it open, so we had an email come into the podcast from the Third Thrill, and the Third Thrill. He was a fan of Steel Saunders, but from what I can understand from his email, he's dropped Steel and adopted us. Because as far as I know, he can only listen to one podcast at a time.
Not very discerning.
he's not a multitasker, but he wanted to ask about data collection. And in that digital nerdy kind of Google, Visa, NSA kind of way, where, you know, all this data is being collected about us, is that a thing now? We just cop it on the chin?
I don't think most people are even aware of how much data is being collected. I had this conversation with one of my kids the other day, because she said, you know, can I go on Instagram? I said, absolutely not, for a whole bunch of reasons. One of the main ones being Facebook bought them a while ago for an insane amount of money, and the reason they did that was just to rape the data fields. But also, it's not a very good idea. In fact, I've been thinking about writing a column, because I really hate those columns about, you know, we've got to protect the kids.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking that, you know, if you are a half-decent parent, you actually shouldn't let your kids on any kind of social media until they're 18. And, you know, then it becomes their decision. But I've advise mine, when you do go on, you actually need Jason Bourne style to create an entirely disposable online identity.
And drop and run at any minute.
You can burn them at any point. So you go to my Facebook page. I was born in 1901. I live in Tuluxapan, New Mexico, and I work for the Gigantic Bombs Corporation.
I love those gigantic bonds you're putting out.
Yeah.
A colleague of mine, his relative, young relative, a nephew or something like that, wanted to work for us, and so he goes, "I'd love to work, you know, for radio. Sounds like fun." And that's the best joke yet. and so the colleague says, "Look, you can't. I'm Facebook friends with you. It's all on public. And you love heavy metal, which is fine. Liking heavy metal is not the evil part. It's just the bit where you talk about wanting to have sex with goats. Like that's on public record. It's in Google. It's on Twitter. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe
it's worse than that.
Goat sex is just maybe not cool.
Goat sex is fine.
it's what you do with the goat afterwards. That's really despicable. Yeah, Drop them on the side of the curb.
Yeah, if the goat's up for it. but it's not just that stuff. It's things like. There are companies like hiring companies now who are just, they're employed to just reef through like the 1,000 or so applications for a job. And one of the things they do is trawl for Facebook. And they're not just looking for you tagged in like a wet t-shirt competition from O Week of, you know, 1987. They can do things like they will hoover up all of your posts for 5 or 6 years, and they will run like a meta-analysis on the language that you used, and they can then push that through analytic programs so that they can decide that on the basis of the patterns of your posting and the patterns of the language that you use, that every 2 or 3 weeks you get a crippling migraine and you're out of business for like 24
to 30 years. So they develop those kind of patterns. Yeah,
and they just go, this person, you know, looks really good on paper and has a really super clean Facebook feed and only tweets, you know, those annoying, you know, Bhagavad Gita quotes.
I can never joke.
Every
job
2 or 3 weeks, you're going to lose them because they get migraines. And you might not even mention it, but they can do that level of analysis on your posts.
Mm, mm. Well, I have an account that's me on pretty much everything. I'm me on Twitter, and I decided to not be an anon. Mm. An anonymous account. Just partially because, you know, I want to be a comedian, so, you know, getting my name out there is part of it. Not every joke's a winner, though, so it wouldn't be a bad idea to have an anon account to test them out on. But I just decided to kind of cop that on the chin a little bit. But I can definitely see the wisdom in having...
You can, I mean, yeah. Given the, you know, the path down which you want to work, you're sort of protected in some ways from notoriety.
Yeah.
In fact, you really seek notoriety. You're smart.
Absolutely, absolutely. And being a comedian, I've got the best defense ever by saying, "Oh, I was only joking."
I'm just trying some material, just working some stuff up.
Yeah,
get away from me, people with pitchforks.
Exactly, exactly. But you know, again, you know, it's a good idea for some people to try and get that. The problem is, I'm not a hateful bigot, so you know, I always feel a bit bad when I tell those jokes.
No, I still tell them. For you.
Still tell them. Still tell them.
Yeah. I've always made a point, and I'm really rethinking this kind of. Now, I've always made a point of having my full name, Joshua Withers, as my Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, in LinkedIn, Google, all the things.
You'd be a radio brand head, right?
Yeah,
you're
talking
about pick the me brand.
Yeah, exactly. It's a personal branding wank term, you know. And I've always been really proud that I'm just, you know, I've got nothing to hide. I just am what I am on there. So you can go back through my stuff, go back over the last couple of years, and you might find some bad jokes, but, you know, you won't find me being a troll, or you won't find me being a bigot or whatever it might be.
Do you ever stop yourself halfway through a drunken tweet and go, "Oh, fuck no"?
I stopped myself through sober tweets.
Actually, I did that just the other day. There was something, somebody was making some comment about something. I thought, oh, and no, that's not going to come out. Because I had this, I think in the context, it was to do with a woman was in social media was complaining about something about Julia Gillard is no longer the Prime Minister, and so feminism is dead, we need to work hard, something like that. And I was just going to, some backhanded, offhanded tweet, nothing serious, because very rarely is anything that I would offer intentionally harsh, angry, or anything like that. It was just going to be here's a joke that's full of irony. And then I went, no, they're not going to get that, and I'm not going to get out of that in a hurry.
Twitter
so
actually
I just
has an
that.
Irony filter. It applies and none ever gets through.
Yeah.
You ever had a fight with someone with like 3 followers?
Yeah.
It just goes on for hours?
Yeah.
Oh, getting in a fight's great, but I see all of the replies to the radio show. Well, 4BC, I see all the 4BC replies, and God, they're just beautiful. Just the humans that you don't know exist. Because, and this is the thing that social media does particularly, Facebook's even worse for it. Twitter, you choose who you follow and you don't follow, but then it's just an analog process. The tweets come, but on Facebook, it customizes a feed for you. And so sometimes you can forget that there's other people in the world than people like you, than your people and your family and your friends. And for example, I've got a little brother who's a crazy extremist. Love him, but he's a bit crazy. And so I see his crazy stuff, and in my world, I think he's the only crazy person on the planet. But then when you start seeing at replies to, say, 4BC, like, they're all out there.
There was a great article written by... I don't know what his formal job is, but a guy that works for either The Age Online or someone out of Melbourne, that his job was to curate and allow or deny comments on articles. So he would go through the all of the sensitive ones and yes, no, no, yes, yes, no, no. Well, and he laid out some rules for if you want to have your comment published, make sure it's like this, don't do these things. You know, we're not going to allow or encourage... Or let personal attacks go on and those sorts of things. And I just went, man, that's got to be just such a soul-crushing job because you see
Oh, my God. Have you ever spoken to Georgia Waters? He used to do the comments at Brizzy Times.
Not about that, but I have spoken to her, yeah.
Yeah, there was one particularly foul day. It's probably one of my blogs. She just wanted to dig her eyeballs out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you need someone in that job because, like, and not only because there's bad comments, because there's always bad comments, but because there's spam bots. You know, I was on an article today, and I was like, all the comments are a spam bot. Great, right. You know, yeah, nobody was filtered that out. Was it
on a mainstream website?
Yeah, it was on a mainstream website. Obviously, right, they hadn't got to it yet or something. But
they're normally pretty good at.
For example, I can say the Fairfax websites are all. It's curated.
Nothing gets through.
Until obviously, I can't even remember which one it was, but I just read an article and I was like, spam bots, ha, lol.
The data thing scares me. As a parent, with 8-year-old and a 6-year-old that are at the moment thoroughly obsessed with Minecraft. And we have some fairly strict rules about their technology use. You know, you can't have accounts. Usernames that anything that involves username and password you can't have yet. Too young for that. Yeah. So it's just mum and dad will log you in and we'll do stuff or if that's required. Or even better, no, you don't get the chance to do that. We'll just do it here. So like on your iOS thing, the Minecraft on that is just it's saved, like local save data.
Yeah.
And you can join in the latest update to it, you can join if you're on the same Wi-Fi. And that freaked my wife out the first time the kids, because they just did it.
Yeah.
Like, there was no question to mum. And all of a sudden the kids went, there's someone else in our game.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelle went, what? And I'm checking it out. And in the end, it worked out that they had just joined each other's game and were seeing each other in the same room. Yeah. They hadn't connected. But that then extends to all this. You're right, social media, any kind of account.
Like, I've had a lot of long talks with both my kids about in-app purchases.
Yeah.
And, you know, the 13-year-old totally gets in-app purchases now, but the 11-year-old still is, he's just on the cusp of starting to understand it because, he's starting to spend his own money on this stuff. And it's tough. Like, you know, you see these horror stories about people getting $3,000 bills from iTunes on their credit cards.
Yeah.
Very, very
easy. Well, it's a totally different business ecosystem, whereas, you know, like when we were kids, if we wanted a thing, doesn't matter if it was a bike or a lolly or anything in between, that was in a building and that wasn't our building, it was someone else's building. And so if we wanted, we'd have to go to their building, they would tell us what they needed for us to take the bike or the lolly. And then we would have to procure the money or the whatever it was, and then we could have the thing. And it was a process, it was a physical process. You couldn't have that thing until you'd gone there, you'd given them what they needed, the money or whatever it was, and you could take it back. Whereas now it's just clickety click click click.
You can't but just be like, oh, there goes my entire allowance on Smurf berries.
Actually, I want to segue because this makes me think of something I was thinking the other day, which is music specifically. The fact that, you know, you can now reach out sort of virtually and get anything you want as long as you know, you got dad's or mum's credit card hooked up. I can recall as a kid in the 70s and 80s, like saving the pennies and buying, you know, Ripper 74 and then just thrashing the crap out of Disco Duck and the Newcastle song just over and over and over again. I don't reckon kids today do that.
Well, the model brother is 11, I think, give or take a few years, and he's from North Queensland. Just flew down the other weekend for school holidays, and we took him to the Lions game, Lions versus anyway, and he saved up $100.
Highlight of your week, hey Josh.
Oh, it was a good game. and he saved up $100 over the last, I got no idea how long it took him to get $100, but it was a pride and joy because he was going to the Lions shop. So he had it. He's into it. He saved. He went and he got his combo thing of a jersey, cap, and a ball. And
I was on RDO the other day because I'd set up yet another RDO account because it was getting embarrassing. Like all the Taylor Swift that was Facebook was telling people at the Gigantic Bombs Corporation I was listening to.
Yeah, okay. Can I tell you something funny? And it's just I want to welcome my wife to the podcast. She's never seen this podcast before. Hello, baby. She uses my Netflix account, which goes to my Facebook account. Yeah. And I've never actually.
How do you have a Netflix account in Australia when Netflix is not a service that happens in Australia?
These are not the questions you were looking for.
Okay.
but it's linked to my Facebook account, and so I've logged into it once when we first got it to make sure it worked. But then if anyone's seen me on Facebook, you know, Josh is watching.
Keeping up with the Kardashians while you're season 7.
Sorry, JB.
I was just thinking, you know, I was on RDO and I'd set yet another account up, and I was just thinking I've got to put some stuff in this for Jane because, you know, she just wants the technology to work. She just doesn't enjoy faffing around with it like I do. And so I'm sitting there, you know, pulling in, you know, Pat Benatar and Madonna and Please Don't Divorce Me. Even though maybe 20 or 30% of the stuff they have is unavailable because of rights issues, they have so much stuff.
Yeah.
You can't ever possibly hope to listen to 1/10 of 1% bugger all of it.
Yeah.
And I was actually thinking back to Ripper 74 and how much I thrashed that into a flat piece of wax. I just don't think anybody does that anymore. And I just wonder whether anyone listens to an album more than a couple of dozen times.
No,
and then they just move on to the next thing.
I'm not a heavy consumer of music anymore. I used to be. Particularly, I think of... And part of it's a technology issue and part of it's the time. You know, like I got my license and I think 1990 was my first summer with my first car where I had my P's and I'm out dry. And there was 3 or 4 cassettes that got smashed.
Absolutely
smashed. And, you know, I lived on the Sunshine Coast, so at least one of them suffered from heat exhaustion and sounded bad, but I didn't care. It was going on again. All of that went on. And I think now, not only have I not bought music in probably 3 years, but when I do want it, like I'll get grabs on the radio or RDO, I'll get snippets of something, Spotify, something, but I won't. It's very rare for me to go, except the album from 1990 when I want to listen to Cold Chiseled Gold, or I want to listen
to bring it back to data mining, you know, like you see your recommended lists. Mm. You know, they've been looking at everything that you've listened to, everything that you've bought so far, everything that they think is you, and then they make a recommendation. And, you know, it's data mining again. And it does the same thing with tailored advertisements. But sometimes they get it ludicrously wrong.
The Monster Mash is just awkward. Yeah. You can't unexplain
that. Well, with the tailored advertisements, you know, they'd obviously been data mining. You know, they data mine your Facebook feed and give you some ads. And so a few months ago, I saw one and it said, Christian singles in your area want to meet. And I'm like, I'm an atheist with a girlfriend, so no. But then, you know, now I'm single again, so I wouldn't mind hooking up with a few Christian. Is there a gap in my logic there?
I was actually just thinking as you were talking about personalized playlists.
Yeah.
In Australia, and I'm pretty sure it still is, the whole payola scam is outlawed. It's legislated against. But online, like in this podcast, we can do whatever we want as long as we don't defame or break the law. But we can say, hey, drink water. Water's great. Go to water.com and get more water today. but Spotify, they can just... Like, because I use Spotify Radio or Pandora. Who's to say that, I don't know, Lady Gaga or insert artist here isn't, or their record company isn't waiting the radio?
No one's to say that.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have said that.
I think there's some SUVs pulling up outside with men in suits.
The NSA logos on them. Are they even in Australia?
National Sophomore Association.
To go back to that data mining question, though, we should really answer it. I used to work for the government. I used to work for the Office of Special Clearances and Records in Defence Security Branch. And
is that a real office, or is this all is it redacted?
No, it's there. It might be gone now, but I worked for them for a while. And the government would love to know everything about everything, but they don't have the resources. But Google has the resources, and Facebook has the resources, and they actually, here's the funny thing. I misspoke before. The government doesn't want to know. It really doesn't want to know the shitty, boring details of the minutiae of your pointless life. Google does.
Yeah.
They totally want to know everything.
The government doesn't want my dick pics, but Google does?
Yeah, they totally want that. That's how all those adverts go.
I've always said to the conspiracy theorists, like, the flaw in your logic is as much as the maps and the bomb points and the smoke and the flame sizes, that's great planning. But I just don't think the government's that smart.
I've heard a saying that was like, the only thing keeping the government's evil in check is their incompetence.
Yeah.
So I think it's sort of fits under that.
But they'll buy that data. See, they know, they've come to catch up that places like your Googles and your books have got all of this interesting demographic data, and that, and so we can purchase that really easily, and that can help out our Office of Redacted to discern where we need to place the next nuclear missile, you know, shelter.
And look, there's even a helpful side to it, hopefully, and this is where Google plays out.
There is nothing helpful about data mining, Josh.
Okay.
It's all to kill us and eat our bones.
Okay, so television. Mock, you have a slight interest in television,
don't
from what I understand.
Don't bring beloved into this.
So television, between shows, between the important bits that we really enjoy, there's these things called ads. There's not many people that you'll ever find that go like, I just love ads. Go to all the shows they play are just shit, but the Channel 7 ads are the best ads. You know, like that's a conversation no one will ever have. But yeah, you know, and this is the optimist pro Google in me that says, what if the 3 minutes between the show pausing for a second, the show coming back, what are the 3 minutes of stuff you're really interested in? Like, if I, for example, I wear glasses, but I don't like wearing glasses. So an ad comes up, Josh, you know you don't like wearing glasses. Here's some glasses you'd really like, and they're in a fancy color you like, and they're made by that designer you think's really cool, and they come in pink, which is awesome.
And then the next one is an ad for Christian Singles.
Christian Singles.
In your area.
Which is awkward, because my wife is sitting there watching with me.
You know it. That's exactly right. Because they've already seen your increase in Snapchat usage to people other than your wife.
But what if advertising wasn't crap, because they actually knew that rather than saying, look, it's Channel 10 and we expect this demographic is kind of watching, what if they say, look, Joshua Withers is watching, Josh is fully into this.
Well, that's like tailored advertisements that they're doing on, you know, all kinds of social media. So
yeah, but they suck.
They do. But if they're not doing them good on social media, what tells you that they do them good on TV? You know, it's a good idea in theory, but in practice, you know, it could work with the changing medium. You know, everyone's downloading TV shows now.
Well, it breaks down at scale, though, doesn't it? Because with TV shows, you're talking about mass audiences. Mm. Where you go to something like this, or, you know, podcasting is really narrow casting to micro demographics. And one of the things I find myself doing, I've got 3 or 4 podcasts I listen to all the time. And, like, they're focused on areas that I like. So, you know, John Gruber's Daring Fireball podcast.
Does he have a podcast?
He does, yeah.
I love Gruber and I love podcasts. I never knew he had a podcast.
I often listen to the adverts because it's about, you know, techie, geeky stuff. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes go off and buy the stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And he can do that because, you know, he's probably, in our terms, he's got a mass audience.
A mass niche audience, because Gruber people love Gruber stuff.
They're all corralled neatly into the sort of tech geek / Apple corner. And
it's the Oprah effect of podcasting. if Gruber thinks something's cool and is going to engage or has found something, we'll get an ad for that.
I already want what Gruber wants, and I already want what Gruber wants tomorrow, and he doesn't even know what it is yet.
But that's all Oprah does, right? Whether it's commercial venture or like Oprah can be paid to say she likes this. I'm not suggesting that's the case for Gruber, but you know, the books that she throws on her books club hit the top 10, top 2 on the bestseller list. like in a heartbeat. It's a commercial decision to do that. There's that opportunity in that area to do that. We know that people like this, we know this is the thing, so we can just nail into that niche demographic and have our thing go from we sold 7 widgets last week to we sold 70,000 widgets now. I've just stated the complete obvious.
What if advertising wasn't bad and it was all because of the evil data mining? And as a result, we didn't have to pay for iTunes TV downloads, or I didn't have to pay the $11 for Spotify, or I didn't have to...
You're starting to see that with services like Google now, particularly if you get it through the latest Android as opposed to the Android most people are using. The cards that it throws up are very much tailored to your tastes and your search history. And you know, being Google, of course, they're going to be serving up ads in there eventually if they're not doing it already. And I mean, that's cool, but I don't see how you splice that into something like Under the Dome, which I'm going to go home and and watch tonight. Like, it's same. What's the audience for that? So half a million, a million.
Well, in Australia, they did 1.6 nationally.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah,
that's fantastic, actually. So
enough for 10 to replay it 3 times.
Yeah. How do you, I noticed that? I thought that was really interesting. How do you micro focus? You know,
I guess the way that they would do that, like this is just an idea, is if you were a downloader. Not saying I am one. I am one. you download it, but it automatically
Morgan Dash Moore.
Yeah, that's how. If it recognized you as the downloader and then automatically had ad breaks in it that it filled in from your, you know, targeted marketing, is sort of how they do that, and then they wouldn't charge you for it, as opposed to, you know, paying for it on iTunes, which is what Josh is saying, which is a good idea, but everyone wants to get paid. So,
bastards.
I remember when I was young and I learned that newspapers' revenue came primarily from advertisements, and I was like, why are we still paying for them then? And it's because they want to get paid on both ends. Yeah. And
it's also about adding value, and there's different things.
And recognizing the value in what you've exactly right.
But also everyone wants to get paid on both ends, if possible, you know? So,
hey, look, I'm not giving away my other end without getting paid.
Yeah, exactly.
The newspapers aren't taking all of that. You know, the news agent is taking a big slice of the cover price, and the newspaper boy sends it around. Yeah. And, I mean, a lot of them do their own distribution networks, but not all of them. Sometimes, like publishers, for instance, when Falafel came out, it died in the arse. That book just came out and nobody bought it for about 6 months or so.
And what happened?
The only thing that saved it was in Brisbane, it was being distributed by an independent distributor. Mm. He got like 30-35% of the cover price, something, and he really liked it and he believed in it. And he just drove relentlessly around the city for about a month or so with a box of these things in the back of his car, just hammering bookstores one after the other. And finally, after all the distributors down south had just gone, this is a dud, and get this stinking piece of crap off the lists, this guy just pushed it and pushed it, and it got into enough stores and then into enough hands that, I don't know, word of mouth kicked off or something. And it
built some momentum.
The appearance on Oprah helped.
Yeah, absolutely.
but it's, you know, that guy, he believed in it, and he earned. He got he said that was his biggest payday ever when that book took off. So that's why.
Awesome.
Distributors need to be paid as well, not just the...
Can you identify that... What made the bell curve go up on the sales of the book?
We talked about it. We couldn't figure out. We tried all sorts of shit. Like, at one point, Michael Duffy, who was the publisher, who'd mortgaged his house to build up the publishing company, he came around with this look of hollow desperation in his eyes. He said, have you got any, like, unwashed laundry, socks, jocks, anything like that? I said, I got heaps. And... he bought himself a whole bunch of biohazard bags.
Awesome.
He wanted to put one like filthy pair of underpants with a book in each biohazard bag and send it off to literary reviewers around the country, because in his mind he thought that would help.
oh god!
I am almost certain that it didn't. Wow!
They got this. Oh, I'm not opening that.
But we did stuff like he just gave me a box and I ran around Darlinghurst, where I was living at that point, looking for houses that I thought looked like share houses, you know, biohazard bags, underpants everywhere, and I'd sort of cram the books under the front door.
No way.
And
have you ever heard the story of someone saying, hey, look, I found your book jammed under my front door, some dickhead put it there?
No, I gave a lot of them away too. To this day, I got no idea why it took off, but it did, and it was about 6 months in, and it was in Brisbane.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, I can only put it down to his persistence.
You won't hear any stories about it, but if you play some UMI tracks backwards, you do start to hear some references to Falafel and the book.
Yeah. So, data collection, data mining.
It's got to be a thing. I think we need it to be a thing too, because there's that opportunity that at all of this data that's collected about us, the stuff we want to be collected about us, can and has the potential to change and shape our online or our TV watching or our media consumption experience, hopefully for the better.
Well, it's not just that. It's also it's how we pay for stuff.
Mm.
You know, how much would you pay, for instance, for a service like Google Maps? I mean, it's awesome.
Mm.
But you're getting it for free.
I would tell them my age anytime they want to let me use Google Maps.
Yeah, absolutely.
How much would you pay for it as an app if it worked, you know? And there was no option to get it free. Like, there's this insane service. You just put it in your phone and it just tells you where you're going. Anywhere on the planet. You pay at least $5 for that. Yeah,
easily.
Well, you don't have to.
Yeah, and like companies like Facebook have so many employees and people spend hours and hours and hours on it. How are they getting paid? It's through data mining.
I want to shut down my Facebook.
Yeah.
I just hate it.
Hey, a friend of the show, Taya Smith, she was on a couple of episodes ago. She was talking to me about podcasting, about making it, you know, professional, making money. And she goes, do you mind selling out? I said, of course not. I gotta pay rent. I want to buy my wife diamond rings. I want to pay her for a car and have food.
You want to buy your wife a spare cat for every cat that you kick over?
I want to have a whole cupboard of cats too. So I can replace the cats that I stand on. So she won't know.
I just imagine all those pull-out drawers. Like about a yard across with 50 cats in it.
Is it my turn, master?
The door closes and they go, another one is gone.
They're all heavily sedated and you just have smelling salts. You click one under his nose and it comes to life. You chuck it up on your shoulder.
Yeah, so I'll fully sell out my podcast.
Yeah, but I'm looking for any opportunity to sell out for anything, you know, really.
What do you got?
Yeah, exactly.
In my podcast, we have fake adverts.
Yeah.
Because I'm
just kind of like a Roy HG style.
For actual like stuff like, you know, there's a great cafe a couple of streets over from here that does a really good big breakfast. So, you know, I just advertised it one morning just to get used to people used to the idea that at some point in the future, when I have amassed an enormous engorged audience, that, you know, we're going to be selling crap.
Yeah, yeah. I'm all for that. It's definitely a thing. Data mining a thing.
JB, have you got a thing for the committee?
I do. Rancid abject failure. That is my thing. Actually, and the stuff you learn from it too. I've had it rammed down my throat this year because I've been thinking a lot about the future of publishing, obviously, and the future of media. I don't know that media has a future in its current form.
Media or Misha?
Media.
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 Different to Misha.
Publishing is not doing too badly. We were, you know, we had a couple of dark years, particularly when borders fell over globally. But borders falling over in Australia shrank the local book market by about 25%.
Wow.
Which meant everybody's income went down 25%.
Wow. So is that saying the borders' mere existence was increasing the market?
Borders rolled in. Actually, you know, people hated them. I didn't mind them as stores.
Like, it was a cool experience.
They kept a lot of backlist and they had, you know, they had some book people working there. But one thing they did do was plough under lots and lots of independent sellers.
Mm.
And, you know, they put a lot of pressure on the chains too. You know, one of the reasons Collins got very wobbly was because of comp from Borders. And of course they died. And instantly you just lost, I think it was literally 25% of the market disappeared. And you had Collins about to fall over and people were worried about the other chains with good reason. And, you know, there was a spectre of Amazon just coming in and eating everybody's lunch. But just the last 6 to 8, maybe 12 months, things have started to get a little better. It seems that ebooks have stabilized at about 20% of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And I've actually sold, like, you know, extra paper copies. And so publishing's not looking too bad. But... the entire, you know, the skills I'd given myself the last 20 years were looking as though they weren't going to be worth a brass razoo.
Hey, you don't work on AM radio.
No, he works in something that predates that.
Exactly. And I was just starting to think about failure, and I took on a job earlier this year, which I really didn't want to do. It was a film writing job, and you know, a dude flew up from Sydney and said, "Oh, you know, you want to do this?" I went, "No, I don't know anything about film." He said, "Well, I'll buy you lunch, and we can talk about it." Oh, free lunch.
No failure there.
Yeah.
So far, you're winning.
Yeah. Okay. There is such a thing. Okay. So I went to the lunch, and he talked me into it, and I just knew when I was agreeing to do it that I shouldn't do it because it's a really specific skill, and I don't have that skill. I've never trained for it. I don't know shit about it. He actually said the first thing we need to do is write a treatment. I went home, Googled up what is a treatment.
Nice.
So I wrote the treatment. It went.
What
off.
Is a treatment? Is
it? It's like a it's a précis of the film. Someone sent me the treatment for Terminator, which is acknowledged as one of the great treatments of movie history. And it's like you're reading a sort of 7,000 or 8,000 word short story about the Terminator.
A robot comes from the past to the future to kill kid from the past. End of story.
Yeah, it was a surprisingly engaging read. Hmm. And so I could do that. I can write short stories. I choose not to because there's no money in it, but I could do it. And then, you know, so that got me a little bit excited. Oh, maybe I'll do this. No, I then sat down to write the screenplay. Oh, my God. I've spent months on this thing just staring at the screen. At the end of the day, maybe I've written 100 words. They're all shite.
Wow. They're an original? What's the pretext for...
I don't want to talk about it because this guy still, he wants... This is his project. He's putting his own money into it. I don't want the stink of my failure. Yeah.
That's right, he doesn't listen, you're fine.
To write the screenplay,
you're writing his film, you're not writing...
Funny thing is, I come out the other end of it. I emailed him about 2 weeks ago. I said, you got to be fucking kidding me. I can't. I got to just admit defeat and failure and walk away from this. And you need to go find yourself someone who knows how to write screenplays. You know, if you're going to do this for real, go off and find someone who does it for real. The funny thing is, having gone through the experience, really, it's a fucked experience. Like, often as a writer, your failure is public. You know, the first version of How to Be a Man, it's just ass. It's terrible. It was another one of these projects I didn't want to do, and I allowed myself to get talked into. And it's in some ways I'm humiliated that first edition is out there. In other ways, I'm sort of glad it is because it just shows you how you can recover from, you know, a really bad mistake.
Yeah.
And having come out of this this really wretched 5 or 6 months where I've just literally been staring at the screen doing nothing, and my other projects have slipped behind, and I just felt worse about myself every day. I did come out the other end realizing I could probably do this if I learned how to do it properly. And so I'm thinking I'm actually going to go take a few courses because I've got books. Actual God, I love books, which I'm writing at the moment, which should lend themselves really well to a big, stupid, senseless,
nice,
explodey,
Michael Bay
action driven
helicopters.
And
Johnny Depp is an Indian for no reason.
Absolutely. And I reckon I could do it. So it's, you know, for those of you out there who've had a bit of a experience of failure, it's awful. It's really awful. I've died on stage.
Yeah.
And it's just, oh my God.
Yeah.
And yet I've gone back on stage and loved it, you know, 10 times more the next time because I didn't die.
Exactly.
You
know, yeah.
It's the thing you got to learn from failure is it's not going to kill you. Nothing except death is going to kill you.
In a business sense, failure is one of the great guiding factors of capitalism, isn't it? Like, for example, Borders. You know, this book-selling thing is not... We're not making money. We'll fail. And as a result, the market will change or grow or contract and adapt. And that's... You know, there's money in, there's money out, and we can employ people, and we've got a capitalistic society.
One of the things that might happen out of Borders going under is that you find 10, 15 years down the track that the independent bookstore market in Australia is much, much stronger. It's already very strong in, than, you know, compared to globally. Like, you go to the US, there's very few indie bookstores. It's not unusual to go to a city the size of Brisbane and not find a bookstore if, you know, Barnes & Noble or Borders has pulled out.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Amazon now owns that market, whereas here in Brizzy, for instance, I can think half a dozen really, really good independent stores just off the top of my head. And I think what will happen in the next 15 years or so is that the market will shake itself out to the point where the books that we regard as shelf-worthy or gift-worthy will tend to get and prize as artifacts from independent stores, and the, you know, the terrible 50 Shades of Grey or Twilight habit that you've been cultivating for a while, don't deny it, Steve Malt, will all be sort of done on, you know, e-readers where people aren't going to see it. So that's my thing, failure. I've failed epically this year, and just the last couple of days have faced up to it and decided to move on.
I'm a big fan of it. I was talking about, I don't know if it was you, Malk, about...
I can tell by the posters around your house, the failure posters. I love failure.
I was talking about Ford, and Ford's obviously come to us point and said, we've got 3.5 years, and we're pulling out of this business they were in.
Two-bit town, we're gone.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people will highlight in the negative part of it, and yes, it's sad that those people won't have jobs, and it's nice to have a local car industry. It's a nice thing, but it's a bit of a cleansing process. Like, we're admitting that, you know, that's not making money. We're going to stop sinking government grants into it. And her, I forget the number of staff, but so whatever the number of staff is, they've got 3.5 years to plan for a new existence. Like, what if I said, JB, like, your writing's doing good now, but in 3.5 years, maybe you could think about something else.
That process now, like, I honestly believe that. Google has eaten the business model of the old media, and a group like Fairfax, who still, you know, pay a lot of my bills, they will be around 5 years from now, but they will look like a very different creature from what they are now. You look at Brizzy Times, which is a really successful website, frequently buries Courier Mail in terms of reader stats. It does that with, I think, 12 or 15 journos on staff, whereas the Courier's still got 300.
Super heavy, yeah.
And 300? Have they got 300 in the building?
They certainly had at one point. Wow. But I don't know how many they've got now.
298 after last week.
And what's happening is, you know, they're shrinking to... Because one of the things interesting about the net, it destroys value. And it's destroyed a lot of the value of old media assets. So they will be around, but I don't expect to be making anything like the money that I make from them now. On the other hand, I'll get my first royalty check for ebook only publishing this year, and it's going to be considerable. And the beauty of ebooks is that they're really, really easy to write, as opposed to, say, screenplays. And, you know, you can turn out an ebook every 2 months if you're not writing a fucking screenplay that's going nowhere.
I'm really looking forward to
So tell me about your mother. Did she ever write a screenplay?
I'm really looking forward to your next ebook, like the top 10 funny things about living in a show house.
I could have done that, you know. I had a surprising number of publishers who wouldn't have crossed the road to piss on my heart if it caught fire before Falafel came out, who were suddenly very keen to come up and rub themselves all over me afterwards. But, I didn't want to go there. I figured, what would be the dignity in that?
Well, we all experience failure in our own way, whatever it is. Look, being a group of four relatively middle-class white Australian males, relationships alone would be a source of failure for all of us across the...
My wife is in the room. I clearly have not failed. In fact, I'm probably the least
failure. I'm not meaning this one. I'm meaning in your history. But it takes either a really significant event or a big person in and of itself to recognize, you know, this is not, I'm not, because a lot of us will plow on in the face of failure and say, no, I'm going to achieve, or I have to turn this around, or I can make this work for me. And it can be a significant moment where you go, you know what, I can plow on and try and make this work. Or just go, no, this has just got the better of me or shaken me, and I can't master this.
One of the things about failing in public is that people... I don't know, people feel that they can't cop to it, almost, that it will end them if they admit the failure. And that's why it's so weird when you see, say, you know, an actor who comes out of a movie and just goes, oh, God, that was crap. Well, yeah, we all know it was crap. But, you know, they always find something good to say about it. And it's really refreshing when you see someone totally arse something up and just throw their hands up and, oh, yeah, my bad. Sorry.
Yeah, I put something in my throat.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely the case because, everyone always, tells me, because I am a huge failure, the difference between failure and success is perseverance.
It's funny you bring up failing.
So I'm in the perseverance stage. I've never had a success, though. But no, like, that's what they say. There's actually an analogy.
You totally made that old lady laugh at your blowjob.
That's true.
Joke.
Thank you very much for that. I feel slightly less shit. About myself. No, there's an analogy that I know is shit now because, it's about Thomas Edison inventing the light bulb. And as we all know, it was Nikola Tesla that invented the light bulb and Edison bloody stole it.
You've been watching Big Bang Theory.
Yeah. But
tell me more of this theory you have.
Well, anyway, there's this analogy that I've heard time and again about Edison inventing the light bulb, and he tried 100 different prototypes, none of them worked. His wife left him, he lost all of his money, he was depressed. And then one day he got one that worked and somebody was interviewing about it and they said, didn't you feel bad about losing all of that time on all those wasted, prototypes? And he said, I learned every time how not to make a light bulb until I learned how to make a light bulb. And, now we know that he was, probably trying to steal it from Nikola Tesla 100 times, I tried to break into Nikola Tesla's house 100 times.
That back door was locked and I tried the window around the side.
Eventually, I learned to climb in through the window. And now I'm, but anyway, yeah, it's all about, perseverance. So I'm trying to persevere. And, I think that that's a very important point because some people give up too early other people totally. Hold on too long. And you just got to gauge whether it's worth it, really.
When I started to write... I started in magazines, and I started out with a cohort of people who are doing it, and a lot of them were good, a lot of them were better than me, truth be known, but I guess a lot of them weren't as desperate, and maybe they had other skills that they could sell and get real jobs, but it was actually just attrition in the end that got rid of most of them. And if you were willing to just keep going and going and you had some kind of talent for it, then chances were you were going to be the last man standing.
Well, that's exactly
the last man stand up.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what when I first started doing stand up, I found some comedians that I had access to ask, and I said, "How do I make it? Because I want to make it."
Sure.
And they said, "Stick at it." They said, "You'll fall down. You'll die on your ass. You'll bomb on stage. And if you keep going, you'll be the one who eventually makes it." So, that's like the one piece of advice that I've been holding on to since I started. And I do mostly good, so I'm happy with my stand-up so far, but I want to get better. So, it's just, trying to spend more time on stage. And if that means bombing more, then that'll be bombing more.
Have you tried being more funny?
Yes, actually. I thought I was hilarious. I was cracking up the entire time.
Not what you thought. Have you tried being more funny to other people?
Look, the audience isn't what matters. They're sheep. They're
it's your
bleat.
Journey.
Yeah, it's me. It's all about me. Yeah, no.
Let me just spin around in my big red chair and tell you how right you are.
Exactly. No, I'd actually like for you to come along and see me do stand-up sometime, Josh.
I've been meaning to. I've seen one or two dates and I thought I've got a haircut that night.
7 years later.
No, seriously, I'm going to be there.
Yeah, 7 years
absolutely.
Later.
So yeah, no, I'm still plugging away at it, and I will continue to because this is my last option.
Malk, no, have you ever not. Failed?
Yeah, ever? Are you asking me if I've ever failed?
Hey, should I call your wife?
Well, you can call my ex-wife, except that she's dead. She actually is. Anyway, heaps, and not just even in grandiose things, which I could reflect on in my life and say, "Oh, I failed at having any kind of real serious career." I had great aspirations coming out of high school about a career that I wanted to have, being a forensic chemist. Did I even finish my chemistry degree? No. Is it necessary to do that to become a forensic chemist? Yes. Did I learn during my time at university studying chemistry how much I hated being in the lab by myself? Yes. So, part of it is some realization and some learning and those sorts of things. I had some shocking relationships that were of my own doing, whether they were friendships or intimate relationships. The job thing, attempts at comedy attempts at writing, attempts at all sorts of crazy. I mean, even I won't say that I've failed as a parent. I will say that I've made some bad decisions as a parent, but that's, there's no handbook, right? That's the old cliche on that. No one sits you down and says, right, now to be a dad, these are the things you need to do.
I reckon we all fail every day as parents, man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you try not to pile up so many of them that it buries you.
It's the size of the failure, right? Yeah. I will make bad decisions, but so far my kids are upright, breathing and clothed and all of the rest of that stuff. Like, they're not, and they're nice humans. They're not horrid humans yet.
Mm. It's all about measuring, like, the yard length that you're measuring on. For example, your kids haven't died yet.
Yes.
And so, in my opinion, complete success.
Yeah, and at my hand, too, so even better.
Like you've got 100% success. Wow. Wow. And 100% success.
If you were a caveman, that would be the only category.
The only measure.
The only measurement of it. You know, now we live in a modern society, so there's a few more, but, you know, that's the primary one
still.
Kid's
not dead.
Yeah.
Check.
That's it.
Wow, you can be the head of our Lions club.
You're now Prime Minister. Because apparently anyone can be Prime
None
Minister.
None of Kevin Rudd's kids are dead. I think.
Oh, hope not.
At least, no, only in their heart.
Oh, wow. Oh.
I actually like Kevin Rudd. That was just open for a joke there. Failure. Totally your thing. I think we should embrace it. The only thing I don't like about failure is that it's often linked with finance.
Mm.
You know, if finance and failure was less linked, we'd just be failing everywhere. I'd have the fail hose on, just failing all over the lawn.
Is it less linked to finance in a communist or a not a first world country? So, like, for example, your New Guinean tribesmen that live in the highlands that don't, they would have their form of you know, trades and all that. They wouldn't, failure wouldn't be linked to, for them, failure would be the kids are alive or dead or,
My older brother's actually in New Guinea right at the moment, and you know, he's trying to get some projects off the ground, and he said that it just doesn't even matter to them. Nothing matters to them. And you know, it's just because they have different priorities. It's food today. Food today. He pays them every day so they can go and get food today. Good. So, you know.
I believe that's the whole explanation for Africa time, which is a whole nother...
Part of me thinks that that's actually not a bad thing, right? Because we can get so caught up in the, I need to have the this or the that, or I want the shiny something or the things or the trip to the somewhere, that I have money to get food today.
Exactly.
Doesn't account for. Mm. You know, you're not saving up for that trip to LA where you want to go to Universal Studios when you get enough money to buy food today.
Mm.
Probably I used to live like that. Yeah, happy too.
I'm living kind of like that now. I've been broke, and you know, I don't have a lot of money now. The few weeks ago, my engine light came on in my car, and I got I had an anxiety attack so bad, I lost all the skin off my hands.
I think I saw you on Four Corners the
other
night.
Exactly. But I put on some lotion, and I raised the money to fix my car, and it's all good.
It rubs the lotion on its skin.
Exactly.
I'm a big fan of failure. I think it drives you to new places. I can think of all the things I've failed at, and they've made me a better person. But also, a lot of them have hurt because they've been intrinsically linked with making money or not making money.
I don't want this a hugely philosophical thing. I think there's a lot to be learnt from being successful. And I don't mean that, you know, I failed 70 times and then that one time it was good. I think there are people that, you know, you can learn things from just getting stuff right. From just, I did this and that, and then this happened, and I got this. I made a smart decision here. I invested well. Something happened. Awesome. I don't think there's anybody that has done that 100% successfully. So they might deem their understanding of failure as slightly different than what we're talking about. But I agree. I think it's when we have the real opportunities for failure, not I put $10 on a greyhound in a horse race and it didn't win. Oh, I'm a fail. You know, duh. But, you know, it's those moments we think, you know, I went through 6 months of shit and I've only just realized now that it wasn't good for me, or it wasn't a smart decision, or whatever. But now I've come out and I can reflect and have empathy with these people, or do these things, or have this understanding now that colors what I'll do in the future. That's good failure.
Shall we deem it a thing?
Yep.
Yeah, it's a thing, and it's a good thing.
Good thing.
All thing.
Nick, have you got something to offer up to the committee?
I do. My one's a bit of a heavy one, but I will do it anyway. I've been sort of the focus of a bit of hate this week. Yeah, I I was online and somebody mentioned that Kevin Rudd supports gay marriage, and I said good, and then all of a sudden I had people all over me for, yeah, for days. Yeah,
males or females?
Males primarily.
Very ironic.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So they were figurative.
Very, very. So my question is, and I've got a second part to it, is homophobia a thing, and can we please work on making it not a thing, because it sucks. I brought some direct quotes from some of these people.
Oh, I do enjoy direct quotes.
Yeah, yeah. Just because, so that we can see their point of view.
make sure you get the caps lock.
I'm trying to be fair. I'm going to try and be really fair. So I said something, about two people, be they of the same sex or different, are able to engage in a deep, loving, and intimate relationship, and that should be recognised.
You hater. To which, Nick, you horrid man.
That's actually what someone said to me. But this is a direct response to that. So they quoted that, and then they said, does rectal copulation qualify? Dipping into chocolate, eating chocolate eclairs in the pastry of shame to shelter your mind will stop there. And I'm like, wow.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Sure that wasn't one of your fellow stand-ups working on some new material?
It actually wasn't. I responded to that guy hard. I slapped him down a bit just because he definitely wasn't. I said, if you're going to do your impression of a bigoted idiot, tone it down a bit or else no one will believe it. You know, you're just pushing a little bit far into that unbelievable stage there. And, I've got another one, same guy, and he actually tries to back up his point here a little bit. He says, marriage shall not be mocked for a minority to exploit legislation by skewing the definition of marriage to access key... This is no spaces, no punctuation.
Okay.
To access key government resources, services, and tax breaks. Why can't homosexuals simply remain as sex friends with incomes to be taxed individually?
Sex friends?
I've had a few sex friends. Not the same thing as marriage. Not at all.
But he's even suggesting some changes to the tax code.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't understand how that works.
I believe that wholeheartedly homophobia is a thing, merely just by witnessing it.
Yeah.
But I was talking to someone, I had a couple over today, and we were talking about gay marriage.
Hmm.
And I was saying that, like, myself, I'm not awfully fond of sexual intercourse with other men.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't at all make me think that I should impart that vision onto others.
Yeah. Some people think it's grand, and that's good for them.
Where I'm going though is I don't understand the large population that feels the need to do that, and whether it's on homosexuality or whether it's on other hot topic.
Mm.
But then there's a line where you draw where you think, well, I'm not cool with murder. And mm-hmm. So if someone else is murdering, I might stop them from murdering. Now, it's not the same thing, but it's that imparting my belief structure onto someone else that you shouldn't murder.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that fine line go? Because I don't care if you have anal sex with a man and you're a man.
I always take the view that, you're entitled to your bigoted fucking opinion. And I'm entitled to call you a fucking bigot because of it.
Thank you, absolutely.
I had the same, probably the very same haters about a week or so back. I wrote that column at Fairfax about misogyny.
Mm.
And unsurprisingly, a lot of the abuse that came in for that was homophobic abuse.
Yep.
So I knew it was coming. I got up in the morning and checked my personal blog, and there it was. Yeah, and faggot, come around, dear, and we'll give you this and give you that. And
then we'll
I got rid of all of those. And then, of course, I went to my Twitter stream, and there they all were, all the same ones again. And I have a standard way of dealing with them, which is I just go, look, you'd be a lot more comfortable if you just came out and faced these feelings that you have. There's nothing wrong with it. A lot of people, I'll be very accepting of you. I'll probably introduce you to a few friends if you want, and because that sends them frothing. And then I'll block them.
Because there's nothing more rage inducing, and that is to give it a good jab and then give them no one to listen to.
Not able to respond.
Yeah. And the really determined ones will set up another Twitter account.
Oh,
and
wow.
They'll come at you through the new Twitter account, zero followers.
Picture of an egg.
And you go again, no, really, come out, block.
Hey, do you block or do you block and report for spam?
I like, both.
Yeah, because I block and report for spam just to see.
How long it takes for Twitter to get to them and go, yeah, no, you are. See ya.
It's really weird. I don't really understand it. I sort of understand, like, I grew up in a really conservative working class town, and I understand homophobia because, you know, it's under my skin. I had to basically convince myself not to be that way. It took a long time, and a lot of people just don't put the effort in, I guess. I know people who are, you know, otherwise quite reasonable people who are just fucked up on this particular issue, and they go on with all that crap about the sewer, the body, and just, you know, if you want to, you can get into the stats with them and say, you know, if you want to go do the research, you'll find that anal sex, for instance, is much more prevalent amongst heterosexual couples than it is amongst gay men. It just is. It's really got nothing to do with what they do. It's what they are. You know, these are people. It's who they are.
It's who they
just
are, yeah.
Grow up and accept it. What the fuck has it got to do with you? It's that great Louis C.K. bit about, you know, what do you expect? To come out in your front lawn and there's two gay men bumping dicks out there. Oh, no, they're bumping dicks.
Oh,
day's ruined.
Oh, man, the homosexuals roaming the neighbourhood just... Yeah. Man, that's outrageous. I think it's... I find it abhorrent. At the core of it, I think it's outrageous that... And you're right, JB. I think, you know, people are, courtesy of living in Australia, if nothing else, open to having their own opinions, whatever they may be and whatever flavour they may take. I don't subscribe to the ones that are homophobic, bigoted, those kinds of things. And will, in some... Well, it used to be, in extreme cases, I've become a little braver, and I don't know why, I will see that stuff go on and to some degree kind of niggle them a little bit. They're just say, well, hang on. And in part, it's to try and understand, why do you think that? What has got you to this point where... And for some, they don't understand. Some of it is like, oh, but my, I read this and I think that, or it's just that I think it's the unnatural deal, or the whatever stuff.
Yeah, I'm trying to be really fair about it, because, like, there was a few who made, like, religious overtones and quoted, you know, scriptures. I don't think it has anything to do with that, because, you know, I used to be religious, not so much anymore, not at all anymore. And... the thing is that I didn't know any gay people when I was part of a church, and, you know, I've got gay friends now, and hey, when I met them, I was like, whoa, you don't have horns. That's good. You know?
Well, they do. You just can't see them because they're wearing pants.
Yeah. Not all the time.
Yeah, that's when they're on your front lawn bumping dicks, mate.
Okay, so like, we all agree homophobia is bad.
Yep.
Gay people are cool. You know, there's nothing wrong with all that, but what do you do? Do we just reply to the homophobic people on Twitter and hope that they come out? Because I see where you're going with the coming out thing, because I reckon a lot of them are really harbouring those tendencies, and they're fighting against them in a public fashion.
But best response I heard from a friend of mine was that people who are that vehemently against gay marriage are the ones who are secretly afraid dicks are delicious.
And they just don't want to find out, or be in a position where they might find
out. That's right. So it'd
be a fascinating study, wouldn't it, actually? Mm. But, in fact, I should have brought my iPad closer to hand. There was one recently where they flashed up, like, a lot of images amongst people who'd been in that sneaky social scientist way, they told them they were testing for one thing, they were in fact testing for homophobia. So the questionnaires, you know, they got all the homophobes in one corner and, you know, all the normal people in the other corner. And then they were flashing up images, and some of the images were of, you know, gay guys on your front lawn just bumping dicks, just going at it. What they found was the homophobes, they secretly quite like those images.
They took longer before answering.
But I wonder, you know, how much that explains the really weird energy that these guys have for leaving comments on my blog at 4 a.m. And then, how much of it is acculturated stuff, like just, you know, old school religious bigotry, for instance.
I'm more impressed that they've mastered the art of typing so quickly one-handed.
I guess to answer your question, Josh, I really believe that the answer is time.
You know, as time goes on, the people who are most vehemently, you know, culturally ingrained in these negative beliefs are going to die out or become less vocal, and it's going to go through.
I think they'll become more vocal, but I think they'll become more irrelevant.
Yeah, yeah.
Because their numbers will just, you know, fall away to the point where they don't count for anything in a pluralistic society.
Absolutely.
Is a tweet or a comment on a blog comment gonna fix it?
Nah, not at all. In fact, it just enrages them, but that's not a reason not to do it. sometimes it's, you know, it's... I used to live in Darlinghurst, and...
it's the happiest place in Sydney.
Yeah, it was a lovely place. And I worked for a couple of gay guys who were aldermen on South Sydney Council. They were the gay aldermen, that's what they ran as. And so I see quite, you know, deeply enmeshed in that community for a long time. And I remember doing a walk around with the cops at some point. And there was a guy who's like 6'5", and he's, you know, a country boy who'd ended up being posted to the city. And he didn't understand the gays, but, you know, it wasn't against the law. So that was that. Game over, you know. They're citizens, they pay their taxes, and he was going to flog anybody who gave them any trouble. And I thought, you know, it's admirable in a sort of magnum kind of way. Yeah. And he put it into work. I actually saw him take down a couple of blokes who'd come up to Oxford Street to do a bit of poof to bashing. And, you know, unfortunately for them, they were too dumb and too drunk to get away with it.
Picked the wrong day to do it because he was on the beach.
That's right. Officer Friendly got a hold of them, and it's not a mistake they'll be making again.
Oh, good.
And that's, you know, that's actually a good thing. That's, in one sense, at a sort of, you know, meta level, that's the state deciding that it, you know, for one thing, it's going to take the legal... oppression away, but also, you know, that's an agent of the state, an individual, a man who, you know, probably like me, grew up in a really conservative environment, and but decided, no, well, you know, bugger it, you know, this is obviously the new way to do things and the right way to do things, and this is the way we're going to do it, and to a large extent, it's those individual decisions made again and again, millions of times over, by people who aren't gay. Because in the end, it's not, you know, it's not gay people who are homophobic for the most part. It's, you know, it's the rest of us, and we just got to get over it.
Solved?
Easily.
Yeah. So it's a thing, and hopefully one day it won't be a thing.
Yeah.
We continue to fight the power.
Yeah. Mark, have you got something to finish with the committee
with? I do, Josh, and it's something that's puzzled me for a little while, and I was reminded of it reflecting on the fact that the Ashes are upon us again, and contextual to that. Anyone that's a cricket fan will remember the now late great great Tony Greig hawking cricket bats signed by, you know, the touring 11, or the, you know, the picture of somebody taking that catch, or the bowling that ball, limited edition, only 500 of the actual thing, and then there's prints, and, you know, buy it for $64 million and those sorts of things. And it just puzzled me that from a memorabilia point, is memorabilia still a thing? Because you may go, right, no, I want that signed Lions jersey hanging on my wall because it looks good and I connect with the Lions. No one's going to then say, and I've bought it as an investment, because in 20 years someone is going to want to buy that. There's so many of the damn things now that it's not, it's just a nice pretty jumper in a glass case.
Yeah, you're probably right. I hadn't thought of that. I mean, as soon as you started talking, I started thinking in terms of geek merch. you know, like, and there was actually that, what was that episode of Big Bang Theory where they bought some stupid big...
Oh, it was the Time Machine Time Machine.
Yeah, like stuff like that. Yeah, you can imagine that has some investment value. But you're right, like those signed cricket bats, no.
Like an actual thing, buying the thing that was used in a something has value and will continue to gain value as long as there are people interested in that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's 70 million replicas of the thing and it's hawked off to, you know, we can all get it and have it fill your man cave, that's not going to do anything.
I guess then it becomes a search for rarer and rarer things. So... I don't know.
Well, that's what it was, because at one point, no one had a cricket bat with a signature on it. And there was none, and then there was one.
Yeah, and I think then, Don Bradman used to charge a shilling or something to sign him. But he was a man with an eye for a shilling.
Yeah, he knew how to make some money.
But you're right. I mean, there's no... The only value of those things is the recommended retail price, yeah. I guess.
So I guess the answer is for any of us, if we ever strike it huge, you obviously your book's going well, only sign one. And that's the one.
It is a tip for any young players listening today. If you're getting a book signed, just get the signature. Don't get it made out to you.
It
has more value. And if you can get a what we call a DocuText copy, the soft bound photocopied advance copies that often go out to bookstores, they're a lot more valuable because they might print up only 20 or 30 of them, and they come with errors, and the errors make them valuable.
There's a emotional value to things as well, and you know, I've got a few things that are of emotional value to me. I got a comic book from my favourite artist, and he signed it and personalised it to me, drew a picture in the front for me. I'm not going to sell that. That's mine.
Sure, it's of a high value to you.
Yeah, very much so.
But that's the flip side. Is it that stuff that's valuable to you personally is awesome, and you would go, I can't, like, you would go to insurance if you're of that ilk and say, I want to keep this, and because if I lost it, it would be the worst time of my life.
You
and
can't
say,
replace it.
Well, the front cover price is $5.95, and you know, we'd give you maybe $5. You know, but the flip side is that the only reason that memorabilia gains any value and is because there's an audience for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you are the one that has the last ever MacBook Air, and there's only one made, there would be a lot of people interested in that. But
that's why I'm holding on to the BlackBerry that I've got. One day.
But it's that kind of thing, right? Whereas we look around now and there's probably all sorts of things where it's technology or remember, like bats that I got at the cricket that, you know, I maybe did or didn't get someone to sign, or those. And it's just like, no one's going to be that interested, right, so are they,
I'm,
really?
For some reason, I'm thinking of that print of dogs playing cards.
Yes! Yeah. Yes!
In and of, it's like the original oil painting of that must be very valuable.
Mm.
You know, the actual print, there's millions of them.
Mm. Yeah. And because I come from a farming heritage, there's always two or three I think they're Australian painters, that there's just prints of these same kind of landscapes that just seem to pop up in homes that my parents' friends have, that are like, you know, and everyone of that kind of age group had, I have to have a print of that photo because that's, well, I connect with the land.
One day you'll go into, like, you know, Clive Palmer's house and he'll have the original, all of them.
I reckon Clive would have prints.
Yeah.
He seems like a prince guy.
I reckon, he totally would. He'd be driving along and he'd see a Westfield. Oh, I'm going to get some prints.
I only said it because he was the richest person I could think of.
Dropped into the framing shop.
Yeah, that's it.
All of the pictures of prime ministers in Parliament House when Clive becomes PM will all be replaced with prints.
I'm loving Clive. I just look forward to the next ad where he just talks about, like, if there's an issue and then doesn't resolve it or offer a solution but just says his name. Like, don't you hate it when you're like, you know, you get a Mars bar and it's like snapped in half? Clive Palmer BM.
He started getting Glenn Lazarus doing it too now, though. That's the worst thing. Glenn Lazarus was very earnestly telling me something through the television the other day about how, you know, the country isn't in as good a shape as it could be, and it'll only be made better through unity. The Palmer United Party will solve that. Didn't tell me how, just that they would.
Well,
this next election that's coming up is going to be a vote for who we hate least, not who we want. So,
talking about memorabilia, I think the whole Palmer United Party will go for a really high price one day from
now. Flutes, yeah, grab them next election.
If I could get a photo of Clive Palmer, I'd treasure it, eh?
They're up there with Agro for PM stickers, right?
So, Mok, what memorabilia do you have around your house? Like, if you had 30 minutes until the fire tore down your house, and you have to get all your memorabilia out. Well, what are the 3-4 pieces you pull?
I don't think there's any memorabilia of value that would be, you know, I have the signed cape that Michael Keaton wore in the first Batman film. There's nothing like that. There would be the NAS that has all of the photos of us and our kids, and the wife would tell me to get the wedding album and those kinds of things. But nothing that would be like, it's
you haven't
the
got a
personal
signed
value
thing?
Stuff.
So have you got anything signed?
Yeah, I do, but again, it's just for like it's more at the time that this happened, or that, you know, someone's very generously given me their DVD that's signed, or yeah, that kind of thing. It's not outrageous that I've got a bat or a jumper or anything like that.
I don't have anything. I was actually thinking of when I was in high school, the Sri Lankan cricket team came to Mackay and played the Bulls, obviously one of the little regional things, and I didn't like cricket at the time, but I was going on with school, and Dad told me I should take a cricket bat to get a sign, so he bought me a blank cheap $1 cricket bat from, you know, local whatever crappy store, and I took it and I got the whole Sri Lankan cricket team to sign it, and then just didn't look at it again.
Yeah. And the irony is that you take that cricket bat to anybody that's, you know, in deals in cricket memorabilia,
oh, yeah,
and they'll look at it and go, Ronald McDonald was not in this touring team.
No, it was real. It was real.
How do you know? How do you know that they all signed their real names?
Okay, well, this is
fun. How do you know that they were really the Sri Lankan cricket team?
Well, I didn't. Me being the little novice I was, I probably could have just gotten anyone that looked ethnic.
Casual racism strikes back.
Hey, well, no, here's the thing. I'm in North Queensland. You're
the home of casual racism.
You're either a white Australian, Aboriginal, or ethnic. Everyone. Everyone. Like French, African, Asian, Asians is a casual racist term. Oh, sorry, but you know, it didn't matter. You were either from there or you weren't.
Furthermore, Josh, age 7, wasn't, you know, on first name basis with the Sri Lankan cricket team, no, so he wouldn't really know anyone.
Had no
That's
idea.
Right. He wouldn't have known if Senil Gavaskar had come up and said, "How you doing, Josh?"
Yeah. I'm going to say, sure, memorabilia, not a thing. I don't have any interest in it. I don't.
I had a lot of signed books, obviously, because I had access to other authors, but. I mean, I got a Generation X signed by Doug Copeland. Don't know where it is though.
It's around.
The one I'd actually keep is an original falafel, not signed by me, but by the cast of the first stage play.
Awesome!
Just a bunch of no-name actors.
That's cool. Awesome.
And yeah, that's about the only one I'd really care to pick up, I reckon. Mm-hmm.
That's really special, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I once went to an Amanda Palmer concert wearing a toga. And I got pulled out of the crowd to have a photo with her.
Nice.
So yeah, that's in my little cupboard of nice things. And cool. I've got a few albums of hers that she signed, and a few other people. But and that comic book by Ben Templesmith, because I just love him.
Cool.
And he drew a picture in it for me. So yes. that's got like memorabilia in its, you know, it's a memory. It's a
that's
thing.
Right.
Emotional investment.
I'm holding on to those, you know.
That's actually, you just nailed it, didn't you? Memorabilia has to have some memory component. Yeah.
And if you take that memory away, it's not even memorabilia anymore. Yeah. It's just an item. So
it's a nice picture in a glass case.
So I think that it is. I think that it is a thing, because I'm holding on to my memories, and I hope that, you know, if I'm senile sitting in a nursing home someday, you know, 2 years down the track, that I'll be able to look at these things and remember. So yeah, I'll say that it is a thing.
I always think back to the very first season of Big Brother Australia, and I was delivering pizza at Helensvale at the time, and it was funny because I think Pizza Hut sponsored, or whoever it was sponsored, Pizza Hut or Domino's, one of the two, but they didn't deliver to the Dreamworld complex, but they were just obviously an advertising sponsor. So I worked for Eagle Boy, so we delivered, so I deliver pizza to the Big Brother house on a quite regular occasion for staff and security. Yeah. And I'm sure the pizza, like, it wasn't a, you know, for the contestants, but because if they had a St. Eagle Boy's box in there, they would have got murdered. And I delivered pizza one night to the guy at the front gate, and you never got inside the front, always just drop off at security. But the guy was ecstatic because some famous person had just been there, and obviously it was many years ago, I can't remember who, but some famous person had just been there, and I give him a kiss on the cheek, and then and he was wearing a white shirt, and they kissed him on his collar. So there was a lipstick on his collar.
That's cool.
And yeah, he was going, I'm taking this home, I'm going to frame it, I'm going to freeze dry it, whatever you have to do. And he was going to keep that forever, his lipstick on the shirt, which means nothing to anyone else in the world apart from him.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that's good. Like, we talk about the emotional value stuff when we connect with these things. I think that's the core of where memorabilia works, when it is that memory, when we are invested in it. I remember hearing a story about Marilyn Monroe. Would take a paper napkin and kind of do that. Would do a lipstick mark on that and give that to people that we and would then sometimes sign the napkin and say, hey, when people ask an autograph, it's just a sort of a very Marilyn kind of, you know, sensual kind of thing, but also unique and a great opportunity that someone would have gone, hey, this is awesome. Mm. And I doubt that she had any kind of foresight what that might have meant value-wise or whatever. But you don't see a lot of them getting tossed around as far as framed serviette signed by Marilyn Monroe with her lipstick and those kinds of things. They're just kind of whether people held on to them because they said, no, this is mine and my memory, or it got lost or whatever in the process, you know? Mm. It's hard to lose a cricket bat. Not so hard to lose a serviette.
JB, have you ever given an autograph?
I've given one or two.
Yeah, I thought so. I didn't want to assume you had done and then hurt your feelings.
It's a good question because a lot of writers don't. David Marr refuses to sign books. I don't know why.
Especially his own.
Yeah. I have signed a Nick Earls book once.
You wrote Zigzag Street, didn't you?
He has done the same for me. We have an understanding. So it's odd. I mean, book signings are bizarre. I remember, I think when Tassie Babes came out and Linda Javan had some book out that week, between us we had like three of the top five books. I had Falafel was back in and Babes was out, and she had Eat Me or something. And we were selling a shitload of books that week. We did this book signing. Two people turned up. We took them to lunch.
Nice.
And signed their books. And then another time, I was just shopping over at Indrapilli or something, and it was before Father's Day. And I thought, oh, I'm going to get Dad a book. So I dropped into Dimmicks and someone recognized me. Said, oh, will you sign your books while you're here? Oh, okay. And then a punter saw me and said, oh, can I get it? And I was there 4 hours later on when the centre...
Wow.
Did they bring you a little card table and a seat?
Yeah, yeah. They actually they had to send out to the other bookstores to get extra stock in. And that was completely unorganized. I think it was because it was Father's Day. People were jumping on the chance to get something a bit out of the usual.
I've seen some very sad authors sitting at tables for a long time though. I mean, awesome that organically kind of happened.
Yeah, it is. I'd like to refuse to do it because you never know how it's going to go. You could have the Linda Javan experience, or the Linda Javan JB experience, where it doesn't matter that you sold 5,000-10,000 copies that week, no one turns up.
Yeah,
and you feel like a failure. sitting there. Well, and you know, and the bookstore staff have got these frozen shit-eating grins in place. And I'm sure people will be along very soon. It's awful.
Can I ask a technical question about autographs? Because I've only ever given one autograph in my life.
Why have you given anyone an autograph?
It was to my wife. I was in a joke about that actually.
He's got a story.
I was in a McDonald's and this is years ago, and because I was on breakfast radio in the town, and I saw my mother and her child might have been 12, 13, 14, something like that. And they're kind of talking and looking at me and
your core demo.
My core demo, mums and kids. And I felt that she was ushering him over to me as he's like, go on. And he comes over and goes, oh, can I get your autograph? And then so many questions come to my mind. Cause I'm like, well, what do you do? And this is my question. Do you give your signature, like your bank signature?
No, I have a signing signature, which is different from my check and
more readable
credit card. Actually, my usual signature for credit cards is just everyone's illegible scrawl. You can, if I sign a book for you, you can see it's me, and it looks like nothing like one of my checks.
So, yes, you
need a different signature.
And is it okay to do it on a napkin? Because that's what I did on a McDonald's napkin.
I think you broke a couple of kind of copyright laws, but
that was a proud moment for me. I thought I've made it.
Oh, you've just reminded me. All right, this is both a confession of failure and what I would deem success. I toured for a year as the sound guy for a Christian band around Australia. And everyone laughed because that's the punchline. A part of the process was, of course, some big concert on the Friday or Saturday night. And we had our own merch table that consisted almost exclusively of CDs and cassettes of the band playing covers of songs that we were doing as a part of the concert presentation. No money's paid to all of the APRAs and peoples and things. Nothing. Yeah. So I don't even know how all of that happened. But just the band's playing covers and then photos. A formal set piece photo of the band, including the sound guy and the lighting guy. And people would, oh, we want to get your signature. And they would go around the band and they would count them and go, we're too short. And a couple of the band were generous and sort of say, oh, you've got to get those guys down the back. And we're inevitably, by the end, I think we're packing up leads and mics and people go, can you sign mine? Yeah, no worries. And same thing, I had the signature for that. Signature. Yeah, the signature for that and my credit card signature for exactly the same reason. Man, I have to tell you, there's not a lot of room on cassette covers to sign.
Being famous is hard work.
Nick Earl says a great story. He was touring. Again, he was, you know, in the middle of some big book-selling period. And he ended up in some suburban shopping centre that was dying. It had, like, one newsagent that was there. And the newsagent was around the bottom bend in the L. So you couldn't even see them from the street. And the lights were sort of, you know, flickering.
It's like a zombie bad movie.
Apocalypse. So he went into this place and, like, half the shelves were empty. And the guy insisted that, you know, he sit at the card table for the allotted hour, and like at the 55-minute mark when nobody had come along, and Nick had tried three or four times to get away, and this guy wouldn't let him. And this guy, no one's coming. And the guy's, just wait. And he came out, and he'd written this little sign on a folded over piece of paper, meet Nick Earls, !! Put it in front of him on the card table.
So, that's there we go. Golden.
Just give it one more time. Didn't work.
That's cool. I remember seeing, going, actually, it was so that I could interview this person. I went to an American entertainment reporter was out plugging their book, and I wanted to interview them for TV stuff. And so I'd been to the big book launch in the city, this sit-down dinner thing that was just flamboyant, extravagant, huge, that someone had put on for him. And then he was going to a signing out somewhere Redlands-ish way to some prearranged by the publishers. Come on, do the signing. It was the only signing in Brisbane. So I went out there and said, yes, you can have 20 minutes with him afterwards and interview him. So I sat through and got to watch that, and he was extremely gracious about it and was super lovely. And I think was allotted an hour or something and ended up being there for 90 minutes. Not because there was hordes of people. I mean, there was certainly a decent crowd, but everyone wanted to have a conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, it wasn't just, so here, can you sign this? Hi, great, we love you, and blah, blah, blah. It was, we really enjoyed the thing, and it's so great that you're out here. And he was so lovely. I just went, man, that is death. Like, he was awesome, but that just must be a death experience. It was like, I'm in a nowhere, harsh fluorescent lighting, in the middle of the alleyway walkway of the shopping centre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They'd cleared the area. There were signs, posters, all of that sort of thing. I was kind of, man, that would make me uncomfortable.
It reminds me of this one time I went to McDonald's.
You idiot.
I'll just say, Mulk, that nobody's ever asked me for a signature, but if they did, I'd sit for 90 minutes under harsh lighting.
You'll have your opportunity.
Yeah, someday. Someday I'll be flogging off a comedy special no one wants, and yeah.
Have you got a signature prepared?
I do actually, yes.
The legible signature.
Yeah. I'm very conceited. I'm very depressed, but I'm very conceited, so I think I'm worse off than everybody on earth. But because of that, I have a signature ready to go.
It's just you dipping your penis in ink and then whacking
pretty
it on
much,
the board.
Pretty much. No, it's like an N.
It's an upside down Y.
It's an N because my name's Nick and Morgan and more written up like vertically. On each, you know, so it looks very pretty. Yeah. It's so pretty.
Cool story, bro. So it's
good that I've got it organized. Good that I've got it organized.
So kind of comedy career, that's kicking on then, yeah?
That's it. Yeah.
Mark, what was your original question? So we can round that out.
Is memorabilia still a thing?
No.
No.
Well, not as a business.
True,
not as a business.
True memorabilia will always be.
Yeah. Not as a commercial business. I've got a friend that operates a memorabilia business in the western states of Australia. The one of them, and he sources stuff. So he'll find your Marilyn Monroe thing and he'll frame it and sell it to you. And I'm pretty sure it's not a legit Marilyn Monroe signature. Just I don't know how many of those are still floating around. But yeah, and that's his thing. And I see him flogging it on Facebook, and he's a great guy, but I'm like, I don't I have no desire to engage in his business.
Well, that's the catch, isn't it, too? We talk about the market being flooded with actual memorabilia. Mm. Then there's all of the fake shit that people are, here, this is the NFL ball that Tebow threw past and did the thing. No, it wasn't. You know, that's probably given to Tebow to take home. That isn't going anywhere else.
Not a thing, hey?
Nah.
This has been the Thing Committee. Nick, plug yourself, mate.
Oh, yeah. Follow me on Twitter at The Gents Militia. I'm also on Facebook as The Gentleman's Militia, which is a podcast with 26 amazing episodes.
Yeah.
Well, 25 shitty episodes and one good episode, really, realistically.
You're building up, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, we'll get it going again. So you can find us on iTunes as well when you search for The Gentleman's Militia. So, yeah, hope to hear from all of you. Please follow me on Twitter. I have a bet going with my friend from The Gentleman's Militia. If I can get to 50 followers before him, then I get he has to give me a massage while dressed as a geisha, and I'll put photos up. So
we're making that happen.
Yeah, I've got 35, so 15 of you. Please.
I can go home now and get you those.
Thank
followers.
Thank you.
That's gonna happen.
And yeah, you'll see my good friend Jared from The Gentleman's Militia giving me a massage.
The photo twit picker, it didn't happen, right?
Yeah,
that's got to come out.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, I'll put it up. You guys can, you know, put it on the Thing Committee if you want.
And look, this podcast won't come out straight away. But, you're regularly doing stand up. Is there a pattern to that?
I do the Loft in Chevron very often.
Do comedy now?
Yeah. It does. Twice a month. First Tuesday of every month, and the last Thursday of every month, I think. You'll find it at Touch of Red Comedy on Facebook. I'm always there. I'm there like every second time they do it, I'm on.
Like white on rice.
Yeah, that's it. So that's my room. So
it's a little room.
Yeah, it is. It's run by Chris Begg, a good guy. So if you guys want to come along on the Gold Coast, come see us there. I'll also be doing various rooms up in Brisbane.
Cool.
But I'll plug all of those on my Facebook page. So if you want to come see me getting better at comedy, I'm pretty good. I'll just say that so that you have incentive to come along. And prove me wrong. Like the page, The Gentleman's Militia, and I'll keep you guys up to date.
JB?
Oh, why don't you drop into my personal blog, cheeseburgergothic.com, 4 o'clock in the morning, and leave me some homophobic abuse.
It's high quality Cheeseburger Gothic, too. It is good stuff happening there, apart from the 4 o'clock stuff. I think that's almost a knitters club. They just convene every 4 a.m.
I can see it on my Google Analytics. About four, there's a little spike as they come in.
Little pink spike. Just pops up.
Call me a faggot.
Yeah.
Well, they've woken up at 3, gone for the morning walk. They've got a cup of tea, sit down at the computer.
Yeah, so I'm going to fix that Birmingham up.
Yeah.
And also, what's the name of your book? I haven't read it. I really want to.
The first one?
Yeah.
He died with a falafel in his hand. It was actually a shawarma in real life, but the publisher thought no one would know what a shawarma was.
You're in for an education. If this is your first experience of JB.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can say that. Were you and I living in the same house together, or did you move out and I moved in?
No,
or?
We were living together for a while. Yeah,
sorry, it's just been so long.
I'm pretty sure that JB's heard every sharehouse story ever now.
I'm just saying, like from a sharehouse perspective, I think you'll enjoy it.
Oh, good. I would like to throw out that you were the best like sharehouse person that I've ever lived with.
So, and John, you were by far the best columnist I've ever read in any columnisting that I've ever seen.
Well, I try my worst.
John, are you flogging anything? Can people give you money? Is there a thing they can buy?
They can. The ebook thing. I promise I'll write some more. But the first one is it's called Stalin's Hammer, Rome, and it's a follow up to the time traveling techno thriller series I wrote, the Axis of Time series.
I haven't seen.
I got hammered for years by people. You gotta do some more of those books.
We want more.
Yeah. So eventually, what the hell? I'll do it. So, Stalin's Hammer, Rome is the first one. It's out now. You can get it anywhere books are found in the form of electrons. And I promise I will finish Stalin's Hammer, Cairo, which stars Prince Harry.
Excellent.
Prince Harry is an essayist guy.
Nice little cameo there.
He's the guy.
Is that expensive? to get him in?
I didn't ask him.
So it's another Prince Harry. If it really came down to it, some other Harry.
It's Princess Harry.
Real life Prince Harry spookily is moving closer and closer to my fictional Prince Harry every day.
Hey, I'm actually, I haven't read Falafel in, it feels like forever. I'm going to revisit it, because I've got Zigzag Street sitting in my bookshelf that I want to revisit as well. I'm going to go back.
He has more than two books. There are other.
But I want to go back to Falafel. I feel like it's, you know, it needs a refresher.
I haven't picked it up in a couple of years. Occasionally I do, and like I just flick at it and shut it.
What's it like rereading your own book, like well after it's published?
It's weird. I can't believe I lived like that. It's like when the stage play. In fact, the stage play's coming back later this year.
Well, it was just in Perth, like 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm waiting on my check. I think it's a powerhouse here later this year in, I don't know, September or something like that. If you haven't seen it, go see it. It's really funny. And I can say that because I didn't write it. When I do go and see it every couple of years or so, because it still keeps rolling. It's weird because it is actually stuff that happened up on stage. And over the years, I've taken a lot of ex-flatmates through, and they're slapping their thighs and they're roaring with laughter up until the point where they appear on
stage. I was going to say that, where they go, hang on, that's me? What?
Yeah, goes quiet.
Awesome.
You're at Mulks TV Talk on Twitter.
You're at Joshua Withers.
You can please rate us on iTunes, review, say really nice things. Stitcher, where else can they? Facebook.
All I need to do is basically get up at 4 o'clock after they've been to Cheeseburger Gothic and come to thinkcommittee.com and just have their say about how we should really realise our feelings for each other.
We could do it with the page views, right? This has been the Think Committee. Have a great week.
You have just heard an unpopular podcast. Find more unpopular podcasts at unpopular.com.au.